From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. When toilet paper and tampons become luxury items, the trivial becomes political. That's one of the conclusions Slavinka Draculich reaches in her new book, How We Survived Communism and Even Laughed. Draculich survived communism in Yugoslavia, a country that didn't survive the end of communism. We'll talk with journalist Slavinka Draculich on today's Fresh Air. Also today, we talk with Indian-born filmmaker Meera Nair. Her new movie, Mississippi Masala, is the story of an African-American who's never been to Africa and his love affair with an African-Indian who's never been to India. It stars Denzel Washington. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews Jane Pauley's new program. It's NBC's latest attempt at a news magazine. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush today announced a multi-billion-dollar program to assist Russia and the other former Soviet republics. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Mr. Bush has been criticized for having moved too slowly in assisting the economies of the ex-Soviet republics to make the transition to market-based systems. Today, the president said the U.S. would join a multilateral assistance package of about $24 billion. In addition, the United States will provide another $1.1 billion in agricultural credits to Russia and the other republics.
The revolution in these states is a defining moment in history with profound consequences for America's own national interests. The stakes are as high for us now as any that we have faced in this century.
Mr. Bush said the U.S. contribution to the aid package is not a lot of money, but administration officials were unable to specify exactly how much it will cost the American taxpayer. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
The House has rejected a bill to keep funding the savings and loan bailout for another 6 months. President Bush requested the measure to fund the operations of the Resolution Trust Corporation, the bailout agency. The vote to reject the measure was 298 to 125. The bill was defeated at the urging of rebellious Republicans, arguing against the continued bailout in defiance of the Bush administration and their own House leadership. The Republicans, led by Representative Bill McCollum of Florida, want to spend an additional $2.5 billion to compensate the owners of 53 S&Ls. Those institutions lost an accounting break when Congress passed the original S&L bailout bill. Legislators on both sides claim the leadership blocked them from attaching various reforms to the measure. The government concluded its closing argument today in the drug trafficking and money laundering trial of ousted Panamanian military leader Manuel Noriega. Melissa Mancini reports from Miami.
Saying the deception, the manipulation, and lies were over, Assistant U.S. Attorney Miles Malman asked the jury to find Manuel Antonio Noriega guilty of each and every count in which he is charged. Earlier, jurors watched attentively as the prosecutor produced chart after chart outlining the general's $24 million in allegedly ill-gotten gains. During its case, the government was able to trace $23 million back to Noriega's personal bank accounts. Noriega's charged in a 10-count indictment of turning his country into a way station and money laundering point for drug traffickers doing business in the United States. He faces 160 years in prison if convicted of all charges. For National Public Radio, I'm Melissa Mancini in Miami.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 14 points to close at 3,249.33. Declines led advances by 5-3 in heavy trading. Volume on the New York Stock Exchange was about 186 million shares. This is NPR. The National Association of Purchasing Management said today that its index of industrial activity showed a strong gain in March. The index is one of the first signs of how the economy performed last month. It's based on a survey of the executives who buy materials for the nation's factories. The index rose to just over 54% in March, the highest level since September. Defense ministers of the NATO countries and the republics of the former Soviet Union sat down at NATO headquarters in Brussels today to make plans for future military cooperation. It was the first time the former adversaries had come together. NPR's Tom Gelton reports.
NATO Secretary General Manfred Werner said the meeting today was a remarkable and moving event that testified to the real and true end of the Cold War confrontation. The ministers promised each other to manage their nuclear arsenals responsibly, to implement all provisions of last year's treaty on the reduction of conventional forces in Europe, and to cooperate in future military planning. U.S. Defense Secretary Dick Cheney suggested the countries of the former Warsaw Pact and NATO might in the future even hold joint training exercises and participate together in peacekeeping missions. Several of the former Soviet bloc states have already asked to join NATO. That's unlikely to happen soon, though Manfred Werner said today that membership rights could come in the future for the former Warsaw Pact states. I'm Tom Jelton in Berlin.
Australia has banned tobacco companies from sponsoring most sporting and cultural events. The ban is part of a law that will also prohibit the sale of foreign magazines that carry tobacco advertising. The provision will affect American magazines such as Time and Playboy that are widely sold in Australia. Australia's sports minister rejected claims that the ban on tobacco sponsorship would drive some international sporting events out of the country. Ross Kelly noted that France, Germany, and the United Kingdom already have similar bans. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. By the time Yugoslavian journalist Slavenka Drakulic was finishing her book, How We Survived Communism and Even Laughed, she wasn't laughing. She was preparing for civil war. Yugoslavia's first free elections since World War II were held in May of 1990. Non-communist governments were elected in Croatia and Slovenia. The republics later declared their independence and the country split apart. Drakulic is visiting the States, and she's my guest today. Our book critic John Leonard gave a very enthusiastic review of her new book earlier this week. The book is a collection of essays about women's lives in Eastern Europe under communism. Drakulic was a founding member of the first network of Eastern European women's groups. She's a columnist for a magazine published in Zagreb, and she's written for Ms. Magazine and The Nation. So how does she think of herself now? As a Yugoslavian? A Croatian?
No, there is no Yugoslavia anymore, and I'm Croatian. I am not only that I am Croatian citizen, but I'm also Croatian. So, you know, it is a strange feeling. I mean, when you are 42 and all of a sudden the country where you were born actually disappears or falls apart, it is one of the feelings that people don't like to talk much about. And I guess it's the same thing over in ex-Soviet Union. You know, we were used, at least my generation, I was born in 1949, and I was used to live in the country that was called Yugoslavia. And it is a kind of a big psychological change apart from war that you have to say, well, I don't live in Yugoslavia anymore. I live in Croatia, you know. There are bad and good things about that, you know. There are, you know, if the nation wants and votes for independence, this is okay for me. On the other hand, I don't want the leaders that are now in power to tell me, listen, your 42 years in communism were not good, this is all bad, these were all lies. Because I think that I have right to my life, and I think that I have right to my memories, and I don't want to erase nothing from my past. The thing is that there is a lot of that process of erasing the past going on in Europe, all throughout Eastern Europe.
Oh, so you think there's a lot of revisionism and people are supposed
Absolutely.
To forget about the past.
Yeah, well, this is. They change the names of the streets, which is pretty much normal, you know. But you know, there is this tendency of the new governments, of the new democratic governments, to erase 40 years of communism, you know. Maybe it is even natural, you know, but I don't think it is good. I don't think it is good to remove all the names of the streets, to remove all the monuments, for example. And there is really, I think, not only revisionism, but very much of the revenge going on. Too.
Has your national identity changed, your sense of yourself?
Oh, it has changed a lot. I mean, first of all, my generation was brought up differently. The nationality wasn't important for us all that much, you know. And especially in Yugoslavia, because we were connected with the world. We could travel, we had passports, as you know, opposed to the Eastern European bloc, which people from the bloc countries couldn't get out, you know. So we were more, I think, you know, connected with the world. And actually we saw ourselves, at least my generation, in terms of, you know, belonging to the world, at least mentally, you know. So it wasn't really a big deal for me to be a Croat, or I went to school with many Serbs or Muslims, but I never could make, actually, and I was never interested in making a difference. You know, it was more of the cultural thing, you know, because, for example, Croats are Catholics and Serbs are Orthodox, you know. So there was a difference to the extent, but it wasn't, in my view, it wasn't very important difference.
Has the Civil War made sense to you?
Well, you know, it's you have to make sense of it. This is because this is where you live and this is where your life is, and you have to make sense of it. And I have to say it takes very long to make sense out of civil war. You have to understand all the historical conditions. You have to understand present conditions. You have to understand that the communism is going away. And then when the communism is breaking down, is disappearing, what is there is nothing but nationalism and religion there, you know, because the communism was such a system that was actually, you had the feudal societies and then you had communist ideology like as if glued to it, you know. And then there was nothing of the institutions of a civil society that were built within communist society. So, for example, you didn't have any, you know, ideas about the civil rights, for example, or about, you know, freedom of expression or all these kind of things that exist in the West. So basically when communism started to fall apart, what happened is that people stick to religion and to nationality, two things that they only know. And paradoxically, I think it's a paradox that nationalism and religion became actually the symbols of freedom in throughout Eastern Europe.
You live in Zagreb.
Yes, it's Croatia. It's the capital of Croatia.
Has there been much fighting where you live?
No. Croatia, Zagreb is a capital, you know, and it's more to the west and to the north. So the main fights have been to the east, you know, and to the south. So one third of the country has been occupied and bombed, and it's in terrible condition. But Zagreb has been only threatened by air raid alarms. In one day, for example, we had 18 air raid alarms. TV transmitter, do you call it TV transmitter?
Yeah.
Was bombed, and the presidential residence was also bombed. But other than that, no, city wasn't harmed. There were other cities that were terribly bombed. For example, Osijek, it is still shelled, you know. They're still shelling Osijek in spite of UN troops coming there. Vukovar, that was, it is a Baroque, wonderful Baroque city, 50,000 people. It was erased from the earth. This city doesn't exist anymore. Then Dubrovnik, it was about 30% of historical monuments have been damaged in Dubrovnik. So there has been a lot of harm done. And it's about, I think now, a little bit less, or about 300 churches that have been demolished by shelling or by gunfighting or whatever, you know. So the war has done, you know, us enormous damage. And always, you know, on the very intimate level, I think everyone asks herself or himself, was it worth it, you know?
What do you think?
Well, I don't know. I don't have answer to that, you know. In order to find the answer, as many, I think, people in my place and in many countries are doing the same thing. I'm a novelist. I'm a writer. I'm writing a book. I'm writing a book, honestly, to find that answer, you know, because this is not the answer that we are going to find very easily. This is the question that we are going to ask ourselves as a nation and as a citizens of Croatia, and I think it also on the very personal level in the next couple of years, in the next 10, maybe 20 years, because the war is actually not over, you know. The troops, UN troops will come, and we don't know what will happen with the borders. We don't know how long troops are going to stay there. Actually, we don't know very much about our future. So these kind of questions, very serious questions on who we are and what was the price and was this price worth it, this has to be answered, you know, on the long term, you know. When you talk to the people from Vukovar, for example, who barely survived it, or the fighters there, well, they think it wasn't worth it, you know. So for some other people who really badly wanted independence, as for example, the top politicians, perhaps it was worth for them, you know. But I think it is one of the questions that we have to answer very, very seriously and slowly, because those are very serious questions.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Slavinka Draculic, who is a Croatian journalist who's just completed a new book of essays called How We Survived Communism and Even Laughed. In your book, you write about how you felt cheated by the way communism ended in Yugoslavia. It wasn't the kind of happy, laughing, smiling end of communism that you found in Poland and Czechoslovakia. What was different right away?
Well, it's very hard to say what was different. You know, I really envied those people in East Germany and in Poland and Czechoslovakia, especially in Czechoslovakia. I think everyone was envying people in Czechoslovakia because they didn't spill blood. It was really very very peaceful, and Václav Havel became president. You know, who wouldn't like Václav Havel for president? I surely would. And then, but you know, in Yugoslavia, things were going differently. First of all, we had elections in different republics in different time, you know. And then also it was it already when we had elections in April and May of 1991, it was already it was tense, you know, the situation was already tense. There was a tension in the air. And somehow, I think there was a fear in the air already. And it didn't bring all these, you know, people in the street smiling, being cheerful because something is changing, is happening. We had also people in the street, but it was different. It was always connected with a problem of nationalism, you know. So it was, I think it was, the tension was already in the air, and it makes all difference in the world looking at the Eastern Europe, you're comparing to the other Eastern European countries.
You say you were even let down by the end of communism in terms of what it would bring you. You always thought that peaches would be sweeter and larger when communism was over, and they were the same.
Well, you know, this is one of those pictures. It is a kind of a metaphor for the better life that everyone expected. You know, in 1989, I think everyone was so very happy and dancing when the Berlin Wall came down. One of the reasons was, I think, consumerism, among the other things. It means that, you know, you instantly think you are going to get it. Color TV, you're going to get car, you're going to get a good refrigerator, you're going to get VCR, everything instantly, much more money, much more everything, you know. But apparently during 2 years, nothing much changed. I think many things changed for the worse because people didn't feel so secure. The safety network that was created during the communist regime, even if it was actually based on the equal distribution of poverty, it existed. People felt safe, you know, with their jobs and housing and the prices of food. And when that didn't exist anymore, people, you know, and they didn't get actually all that they expected, all the beautiful life, you know, that you see on American TV, especially on American TV. And then people were actually disappointed. So this is, I think we should take it as a metaphor, you know. And it is kind of sad that because for during communism, people were, you know, they were used to expect better life. They were telling us, well, you know, the better future, the brighter future, as we called it, is going to come. And, well, it seems it's not coming. I mean, you have to work for that brighter future, and somehow it is disappointing.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Slavinka Draculic, and she's a Croatian journalist who has a new book of essays called How We Survived Communism and Even Laughed. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Croatian journalist Slavinka Draculic is my guest. You say that you think women carried the biggest burdens of everyday life under communism in Eastern Europe. Give me some examples of that.
Well, you know, here you say that, for example, women have a double shift, that they work, at their working places, and they come home and they work at home, take care of the home completely, right, of children, of everything, cooking and so on. I think for women in Eastern Europe, it was triple, you know. They had a triple burden because they not only have to take care for in a very patriarchal society, you know, you have to know that throughout Eastern Europe, the society is really very patriarchal. circle, it means that men are not helping women at all. It means that we have the emancipation on a public level, you know, but not in the private sphere. So it is not that you have to take care only of your family, but you have to provide for your family. It means that you have to find the food for your family. There are no facilities, there are no machines that would help you, there are no there is no food enough. So you actually spend much more time and you have to work much more much harder than women in throughout Western Europe, you know. And men, they can come they come home and they read, sleep. I mean, you know how men are.
I remember a while ago I interviewed Francine Duplessis Gray after her book about Soviet women, and we got to talking about the lack of Tampax and sanitary napkins for women there. And I got a letter from a male listener who said, how can you talk about such trivial things on the radio?
Well, this is the problem.
I'd like you to explain why the question of tampons and sanitary napkins is not a trivial question.
Well, I think it's a basic question. It is a basic question on several levels. Number one, it is a basic question because it says very much about planned economy. It says how economy in communism works. Tampax as well as a toilet paper you can use as the example that the planned economy in communism actually doesn't work. And it doesn't work because it doesn't, not only, you know, you have these 5 years plans, you know, and these 5 years plans always take in account important things like, I don't know, production of the steel, but they never come to the everyday trivia. And I think on that level, of the level of the everyday trivia, this is where exactly communism failed. It failed on the Tampax, it failed because Tampax and the toilet paper and the food are bare necessities. So you can produce steel, but if you cannot produce bare necessities for the people, people are not going to go with that system. They're not going to trust that system. And I think this is basically the question, or the answer to that question is trust. People didn't trust that. Women couldn't trust that because they didn't have really, not only Tampaxes, but they didn't have even smaller things like, I don't know, you know, if you don't have a choice, and this is one of the very important things to have in your life, at least a small choice.
So now that communism has fallen, can you get tampons in where you live?
Well, no, of course not. I mean, if you go to Romania or to Bulgaria, you're not likely to find either tampons or toilet paper. The problem is, however, that it is those societies are in transition. It means that the market economy didn't come yet there, you know, with good and bad things, because I have my opinion on that too. But I think that eventually, you know, wherever there is a possibility of private initiative, there will be a way, you know, to give these necessities to people. So probably they will have to pay very, very high price for that in terms of money, you know, because it's not going to be cheap. It's still going to be some kind of luxury, some kind of privilege in a very poor society, in a very poor economy. But at least you will have that, you know. But it really proves that you cannot build a system from above. You cannot build a system that doesn't take into account what people really need, from food to Tampax to human rights issue.
What's the status of abortion now in the republics that used to be Yugoslavia?
Well, the status is good, you know. As far as nothing changed. But what I'm very much afraid of is, as I mentioned before, is the influence of the Catholic Church. The thing is that in Croatia, what happened is that one manager of one hospital, he banned the abortion in his hospital, which is entirely against the law, you know. He did it in November. And all of a sudden, that I thought that, you know, this would not happen. But what happened is that there was a lot of letters to the editors, there was a lot of articles, there was a lot of pressure, you know, public pressure, and it became an issue in Croatia. So he was forced to withdraw, of course, you know, because this was not really according to law. But it shows both the tendency to restrict the right and also the tendency of women and of people not to give up.
Now, you were the co-founder of one of Yugoslavia's first feminist groups, or maybe I should say of Yugoslavia's first feminist group. This was organized in 1978.
Yes.
What were the first issues that you and the other women in this group were really desperate to talk to each other about?
Well, first of all, we were desperate to make people realize that there is such an issue, you know, because what the answers that we got from the government, from the official organization of women that always existed, you know, connected with the Communist Party, there was always one state organization. They were asking what do you want? I mean, why do you want even to bring these issues of women being unequal to men or whatever when you have law that equals men and women, you have equal rights. What actually do you really want? Now, what we wanted is to present people with the problems that were never named in our country. For example, problem of rape, of problem of domestic violence, of problem of not being, in other words, not being emancipated in a private sphere. Or, you know, in a patriarchal society like in Yugoslavia, it is very common that men beat their wives when they come home, especially in the villages, you know. And for these women to realize that it doesn't have to be so, it is a major thing. It's a major issue, you know. And there are many. For example, child molesting. This is a question that has never, even until now, has never been addressed in that country. So there are many, many, many issues of that kind that we were, keen to talk about. And this is why we gathered. But it was very difficult. It was a desperate struggle because everyone was against us, principally because. It was as if this is the feminism is influence of the bourgeois ideology from the West, and this shouldn't be we shouldn't be influenced, you know, by this kind of bad ideology. So it was feminism was given bad word right from the very, very, very beginning.
Well, what kind of contact did you have with feminist groups in the West, and how do you think your brand of feminism in Yugoslavia compared to what American feminists wanted and needed?
Well, it's an entirely different thing. You know, I think that the international feminism went through different phases. At one point, we thought that we all have the same problems. But then we realized that the problems varies to, they are different according to the region where people live. And I think that eventually American feminists who tended at the beginning to be the leaders of the world feminist movement eventually realized that this is not, it couldn't be done, you know. You cannot lead the feminist world movement from the United States of America. You might have facilities, you might have money, you might have books on that, you might have this and that, but you don't realize what are the regional problems. But I've seen the tendency right now after 1989 for many women scholars to go there and to look at the lives of women there, and there is an essay in the book about that, about theory, I mean feminist theory and the real life in Eastern Europe, and seeing the life in Eastern Europe through their glasses or through their eyes, you know. In other words, not seeing it realistically, you know. First of all, there is no movement there. And on the other hand, women there are afraid to organize. You know, it wasn't possible to organize on the grassroots level. So if you come to women and say, let's organize a feminist group, women will get afraid of that. So you have to work on the different issues. I think the way to work there, the way feminism works there, worked there and is going to work is to concentrate on specific issues, you know, and not even to mention very much the word feminism, just to concentrate on the problems that women have and start to work on the grassroots level. And this is the only way it could work. And I think this is the only right way. But the issues are different, you know. Before we had abortion, women in the West didn't have abortion, you know, so we had maternal leave, paid maternal leave, 1 year maternal leave, 2 years maternal leave. This is what women in this country never had. So the issues are different, and I think the approaches should be different. And I think women slowly start to realize that on the both sides.
How did you learn to speak English so fast?
You
talk faster than I do.
Yeah, the thing is that I really speak fast. They always tell me to slow down. I'm sorry. I mean, I make terrible mistakes, but I always tend to, you know, I don't know. I didn't learn it to speak fast. I just learned it. And because I speak fast any language. And I speak fast Italian, too.
Slavenka Draculic is the author of the new book, How We Survived Communism and Even Laughed. I'll spell her last name for you. That's Draculic. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Thank you.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Mira Nair's 1988 film Salaam Bombay was about the homeless children of India. Nair was born and raised in India. Her new film, Mississippi Masala, was shot in the American South. It stars Denzel Washington as an African-American who falls in love with an Indian woman who grew up in Africa. Coming up, we talk with Nair about what unites and separates people of color in America. And TV critic David Bianculli tells us about Jane Pauley's new news magazine, Dateline NBC. It premiered last night. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. CIA Director Robert Gates has presented a proposal to a joint session of the House and Senate Intelligence Committees to reorganize U.S. intelligence. NPR's Neil Conan reports.
The hearing was extraordinary in several respects. It was the first ever joint session of the House and Senate committees, and it heard a public presentation unprecedented in its length and detail. Director Gates read a 36-page report and answered questions for 2 hours afterwards. His proposal incorporates some of the elements included in a bill sponsored by the Intelligence Committee chairman. The Senate's David Boren estimated there was 75% agreement, but Gates resisted reorganization that would strip the Secretary of Defense of much of his intelligence role, and he opposed the creation of a single agency to handle all imagery, ranging from pictures by reconnaissance aircraft to super-sophisticated radar satellites. Another disagreement was on the budget, and the session ended as Republicans and Democrats from both the House and Senate said there are going to be cuts. This is Neil Conan in Washington.
Democratic presidential contender Bill Clinton gave a foreign policy address this morning in New York City, and he accused President Bush of moving too slowly on aid to the former Soviet Union. Clinton criticized the president for waiting months to present a Russian aid package and said that Mr. Bush had failed to get tough with China, despite its contempt for democracy and human rights. The chairman of the Conference on Yugoslavia, Lord Carrington, says that progress has been made during talks on solving the nation's crisis. But as Pierre Vickery reports, at least 8 people have died in the last 24 hours following a series of artillery shellings and explosions in both Croatia and Bosnia.
Sarajevo State Television reported a series of clashes in towns throughout the republic, with a number of grenade attacks on shops, cafes, and bus stations, and mortar and artillery bombardments in at least 5 Bosnian towns. The Serbian news agency Tanjug said tension was high in the Bosnian border town of Jelina, with telephones cut and running street battles between local ethnic militias. Croatian radio reported attacks on several towns in the east of the republic, with Osijek, Vinkovci, and Valpovo coming under heavy attack by Yugoslav army artillery. Serbian television confirmed the bombardment, but said the Federal Army was only responding to what it called Croatian provocations. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
UN officials say Israeli soldiers clashed with Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, and at least 4 Palestinians were killed and dozens of others were injured. One Israeli soldier was also killed. It was the worst confrontation in the occupied territories involving troops in 3 years. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 14 points to close at 3,249. This is NPR News. President Bush announced today that the U.S. will contribute to a $24 billion aid package to the former Soviet Union. The aid package is sponsored by the so-called Group of Seven. And German Chancellor Kohl says $18 billion will be provided in loans through the International Monetary Fund and $6 billion to help stabilize the ruble. Mr. Bush said that he will make another $1.1 billion available in credit guarantees. It appears the amount of U.S. aid included in the Western assistance package would come to about $2 billion. A labor dispute between Caterpillar and the United Auto Workers Union has escalated. The company is warning strikers to go back to work Monday or be replaced permanently. The union has responded by expanding its partial strike. Jim Dugan, a member station WCBU, reports.
Caterpillar says it wants to bring the workers back to end the hardships the union members and the company has endured over the course of the five-month-old strike. Caterpillar Group President Jerry Flaherty.
Caterpillar will begin recalling laid-off employees and taking applications for new permanent employees to fill the jobs of striking employees who fail to return.
Flaherty would not say when the company might hire replacement workers. Meanwhile, the UAW's response to the company's announcement was to pull another 1,800 workers out at four Caterpillar facilities, bringing the total number of strikers to 12,600. The union says the callback and the threat of hiring replacements is an effort by Caterpillar to break the union. The company says that's not so. For National Public Radio, I'm Jim Dugan in Peoria, Illinois.
On Capitol Hill, the House has turned down a $17 billion measure to continue funding the Savings and Loan Cleanup Agency. By a surprising 298-125 vote, the House turned down the funding bill in defiance of the Bush administration. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. You may know my guest Mira Nair as the director of the 1988 movie Salaam Bombay. It was about homeless children in Bombay, and it starred children who Nair found on the streets. Nair is an Indian filmmaker who studied theater and acting in Delhi and then came to the States to study at Harvard. Her new film, Mississippi Masala, is about an Indian woman who was born and raised in Uganda but flees with her parents to America during the rule of Idi Amin. They settle in Mississippi, where they manage an Indian-owned motel. The girl, now a 24-year-old woman, falls in love with an African-American played by Denzel Washington. Sure, they're both people of color, but her family is upset that she's getting involved with someone who's not an Indian. In this scene, her father, played by Roshan Seth, is confronted by Denzel Washington.
I see. So you think I ain't good enough for your daughter, is that it?
No, that's not it. Mina is free to love anyone, to live as she chooses. I respect her freedom. But that does not absolve me of my responsibility as a father.
Well, no disrespect to you, sir, but she's a grown woman and we care for each other very much. Now, I think that's all there is to it.
You know, once I was like both of you, I thought I could change the world, be different. But the world is not so quick to change. Mina is my only child. I don't want her to go through the same struggle as I did.
Struggle? Look, I'm a black man born and raised in Mississippi. Ain't a damn thing you can tell me about struggle.
What do you know about my...
No, I know. I know. I know you and your folks can come down here from God knows where and be about as black as the ace of spades, and as soon as you get here, you start acting white and treating us like we your doormats. I know that you and your daughter ain't but a few shades from this right here. That I know.
Mississippi Masala was filmed in the U.S. and in Uganda. I asked Mira Nair what gave her the idea of making a movie about the relationship between an African-American man who had never been to Africa and an African-Indian woman who had never been to India.
The seed of the idea really was exploring the relationship between a black and brown, you know, black and brown communities. And one always thinks of racism as between black and white. And I know, coming from India as I do, with no interaction really with any kind of African community growing up, that there is still within our own community a consciousness of color, of fair being beautiful and of dark not being so beautiful. And coming to America as a student, I found being brown, being Indian, gave me a kind of freedom and flexibility to move freely between the black and white communities. And despite that, I felt always some kind of invisible lines always sort of rearing their heads at some point. And this gave me the original idea to explore this theme of race between black and brown. But then reading up more about it, I came upon a wonderful article on the Asian expulsion from Uganda. And we are, I mean, I meet so many Asians who look so much like me who've never been to India, you know, sort of the quintessential Asian diaspora from Guyana or West Indies or Africa or wherever. And that is extraordinary to me to meet people who are so Indian in even the way they grew up, but yet kind of frozen in their Indianness, who think of India as a kind of homeland but who've never been there. And I think the parallel to the whole African-American situation here is a very real one. And the Asian expulsion from Uganda, when Idi Amin threw out 80,000 Asians practically overnight after three generations of living there, seemed to me a point in history where these tensions reached a very sort of head, which became the leap-off point for this movie.
I'll confess that until I saw your movie, I didn't realize that there had been so many Indians living in Uganda and that they were then later expelled. What brought them there in the first place?
Well, the British, as you know, colonized India in the 1800s, and the British also colonized major parts of East Africa. When they colonized East Africa, they wanted to build a railway through major parts of East Africa and found that neither the British technicians could stand the tropical conditions and nor did the African indigenous Africans there have the skill to do this. So they shipped in as indentured laborers, much as they did in the West Indies, laborers from India. So in the late 1800s, a number of Indians were brought into East Africa as indentured labor. Most of these Indians left back for India, but about 25% of them stayed on. That was the first ground, you know, the first ground was laid in this way for Indians to begin their lives there. And as they settled down, they sort of sent for wives from India and the network sort of grew, the community grew.
It strikes me that the cast that you assembled for your movie is as multicultural as the story of the movie itself. You have African-American actors and Indian-American actors and Indian actors and actors from Uganda. and I'm wondering if the acting styles from each of these cultures was really different and if you had to find some way of taking these disparate styles and bringing them together for the movie.
Well, for me, masala is a collection of Indian spices of different colors. It means, for me, I conceived of the entire film as a masala, the casting, the music, the locales, you know, and the themes, of course. The actors that I assembled particularly for their particularity, if I may. I didn't want to flatten anybody out and make them sort of a generic American or a generic sort of flattened out character, because I believe life isn't like that. So I reveled in the sort of soap opera acting tradition that one of the Indian actors came from the legendary song and dance tradition that the mother, Sharmila Tagore, comes from, you know, from the non-acting tradition of Sarita Chowdhury, who plays the major role opposite Denzel Washington. For me, this was the challenge was to keep the particularity of each character and each human being that I had invited to be a part of this masala, and yet create a seamless universe. I wasn't interested in sort of Alec Guinness playing an Indian, like Passage to India, you know. It was very exciting to pull in actors of various traditions that I had admired for so long, and you know, ask them to be part of this masala world.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Meera Nair, and her new movie is called Mississippi Masala. She's also the director of Salaam Bombay. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Film director Meera Nair is my guest. You were talking before about being between black and white when you moved to America, that you could kind of go, you were part of neither culture, but you were comfortable in both, and you had a kind of entrance into both as an Indian. And you had said somewhere that when you came to America, you instinctually felt in solidarity with black people. What gave you that instinctual sense of solidarity?
The warmth, you know. I really felt the physicality, the communal, you know, the sort of communal living of people knowing, you know, having large sort of extended kinships, whether they be real families or whatever, but a feeling of living with a lot of people. And just the sort of living from, you know, the visceral living. I mean, I could really sense a human connection. I responded to that emotion very much. That's the kind of way we live in India. And being together with people, the physicality between us, the fact that you're not, you know, don't have a sense of being alone in the world, that there are people who know your business. And I like that.
You know, one of your earlier films was a documentary made in India about how amniocentesis has led to selective abortion in India, where female fetuses are selected to be aborted in many families because girls aren't as valuable in the culture, in part because you need a dowry for the girl to get married, and the girl leaves and goes to the husband's family. There's no one to carry on the family name.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if when you were growing up, you were aware of the fact that girls seem to have less of a value than boys in that respect.
Well, I came from a fairly liberal family, and I have two older brothers, and I'm the youngest, and then the only daughter. And for me, it was actually a great advantage. One, because I was encouraged as much as the boys were. And secondly, because there was a much greater pressure on the boys to be this, that, or the other. And that pressure was not really placed on me, even while I was encouraged in every other, you know, in every aspect of schooling and growing up. Since that pressure was not on me, I was left to really do what I liked to do and what I wanted to do. And since I wanted to, I was an actress in an amateur level in India. That was fairly unusual, but my mother still encouraged me to pursue it. So coupled with not really having to get all the good grades, I could still be allowed to, you know, develop my interest in theater, which really was the springboard for being a filmmaker now. So I did come from a fairly unusual background in that respect.
You said that when you came to America, you felt this instinctual solidarity with African Americans. I'm wondering if you felt that African Americans felt that same instinctual solidarity with you, or if it was more one-sided than that.
Well, I don't know. You'll have to ask them. But I do remember feeling this solidarity. I felt sometimes a tension amongst black women when black men would consider me possible partner for them, or, you know, like I was not a white person, I was a third world sister. And that was threatening in some ways to the African American women around. And so I remember my friends really being more from Jamaica and the West Indies more than African American women, my women friends, and we were very close. So I remember that sort of sense of resentment sometimes, you know.
Is race and culture still an issue for you now in terms of fitting in? You've been living in America for a long time. You've been making movies here. Are you self-conscious about being from another country now?
Being from another country is always a strong part of me. I see it really as my strength, not as anything to be to work around. Initially, when I graduated from college and I went back and forth to India, it used to be a source of confusion to me. Should I move back? Should I stay here? Should I place my roots? All those kinds of things. Then I began to use that confusion in my work. And then I began to get used to the fluidity of moving back and forth. But I think, as Nehru said, you have to be very local to be universal. And I feel very, very much rooted in India in a certain way. In fact, I moved out of, I don't live in New York anymore. I don't live in the States anymore.
Oh.
In a everyday sense of the term, you know.
Where are you living?
I live in Uganda now.
You're kidding. Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, I do.
Why did you move to Uganda?
Well, I sort of fell in love with the country and with one person, and I live there as a result. And it's not quite India, but we are sort of setting a base in Uganda and in India this year. And I expect to be moving back and forth between Uganda and India.
So is the person who you fell in love with an Indian in Uganda?
You're right.
Wow, so you're in the middle of so many different cultures.
Right, now I'm a genuine masala.
And you met this person making the movie?
Right, right. So, so now I'm kind of everywhere. But Uganda is very similar to India in so many ways, and it makes me, I feel just so much more at home there, you know. I was sort of tired of New York is a great place to work in, but not such a great place to live in. And I've since had a child, and I just don't expect to raise a kid in Manhattan. No, thank you. So
did you want to raise the child in Uganda?
In India, really. So we're keeping that open. But I'm in the middle of a lot of things right now.
I was wondering if you were still in touch with any of the kids who were your actors in Salaam Bombay, which is a movie about homeless children in Bombay, and you used children who were really homeless to star in it.
Yes, I'm in touch with almost all the children from Salaam Bombay. We set up, from the profits of the movie, a part of the profits, Salaam Balak Trust, which is a non-profit organization in India that is funding learning centers for street kids, not just the kids from Salaam Bombay, but for other kids like them. And now we have three such centers in Bombay and Delhi and Orissa. We made the movie based on these extensive workshops with street kids who then performed themselves, acted, as close as possible to their lives on screen. And these workshops were not just designed to teach a kid how to act or anything, but they were fairly holistic in their design, between providing literacy and coordination and some sort of creative expression, things like that. And these learning centers that we are running now for the last 3 years are sort of takeoffs on that workshop design. In fact, we are using all the benefits from the premieres of Mississippi Masala all over the world to keep the Salaam Balak Trust running. Some of the kids from Salaam Bombay are in these centers, but they are really much older now, and each one is really pursuing what he or she wished to do at that time.
What is the leading actor from Salaam Bombay doing now?
Shafiq Sayed, who played Chaipao, the tea boy, is now working in Delhi in a film studio, a small film studio, as an assistant camera person, learning how to use the camera and lights. And he has dinner with my mother every Wednesday night.
Oh, that's great.
Yes.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Meera Nair directed the film Mississippi Masala. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we have news today of President Bush's announcement of U.S. aid to the Commonwealth of Independent States, most of it to Russia. Also, some political reporting, both from New York State, where we hear from Maria Hinojosa what the issues on the minds of New York primary voters are, and also from Britain, where there's a general election next week, and Michael Sullivan reports on how it is that the Labour Party and its leader Neil Kinnock appear at the moment to be poised on the verge of success. We will also hear about the discovery of what may be the largest living organism ever known.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Last night, NBC News launched its 18th primetime news magazine, hoping this one would be successful. TV critic David Bianculli saw the show and has a review. Here's how the program started.
This is Dateline NBC with correspondents Brian Ross, Michelle Gillen, Arthur Kent, and Deborah Roberts. Now, from our studios in New York, here are Stone Phillips and Jane Pauley.
Welcome to our first show. Stone and I will be here every Tuesday night at 10 with stories of our times from the places where people are making news, Datelines, which is how we chose our name.
Be honest, Jane. The real reason you guys called the show Dateline is because it sounds as much as possible like ABC's Nightline, and everybody at NBC would kill to have its own Nightline. Will Dateline NBC succeed where 17 previous NBC news magazines failed? Maybe. Last night's show was solid enough, and Brian Ross's investigative piece on an election fundraiser con man was vintage 60 Minutes. Bad guy gets nailed on camera, gets furious, and gets the hell out of there. But if Dateline NBC survives, it won't just be because it develops into a solid news show. It's because success in the 90s is defined a lot differently than when NBC launched First Tuesday back in the 70s. To TV networks today, success can mean more or less than getting a decent rating. It can also mean spending less money to produce an hour of primetime programming and giving existing shows like Today and the NBC Nightly News with Tom Brokaw a promotional shot in the arm. The networks didn't always think this way. Back in the late 70s, when 60 Minutes first cracked the top 10, CBS News executives said they didn't want to dilute that show by doing a spinoff. But now, CBS has 48 Hours, which is hosted by CBS Evening News anchor Dan Rather, and Street Stories, a 48 Hours spinoff that's hosted by Ed Bradley of 60 Minutes. Two things made the networks change their thinking. One was the success of Nightline, which built a new audience base in a new time slot. The other was the decline of network audience shares and revenues, which made so-called reality programming a lot more popular, at least to the network bookkeepers. A glitzy news magazine like Dateline NBC costs less than an hour of fluff like Tequila and Bonetti. And primitive shows like Top Cops and Eyewitness Video are incredibly cheap to make. The bottom line, though, isn't always the bottom line. ABC has succeeded in building new news department franchises because it has the best bench strength in the business. Peter Jennings on ABC World News Tonight, Ted Koppel and Jeff Greenfield on Nightline, Hugh Downs and Barbara Walters on 2020, Diane Sawyer, Sam Donaldson, and Chris Wallace on Primetime Live, and maybe best of all, David Brinkley on This Week with David Brinkley. CBS is starting to branch out, but not with that kind of roster. And except for John Chancellor doing commentary on the evening news, what else does NBC have? Arthur Kent and Brian Ross are being tapped for Dateline NBC, but Faith Daniels is busy with her daytime duties, and NBC doesn't really have anyone else left to tap. And there's the irony. NBC and CBS saved a lot of money a few years ago by refusing to give some of its correspondents the money or airtime they wanted. And that's why David Brinkley, Barbara Walters, Diane Sawyer, Hugh Downs, and Chris Wallace now work for ABC. By doing that, and by not replacing the defectors with equally talented and high-paid journalists, NBC and CBS save money then. But they're paying for it now.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air was produced today by Fred Landrell, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet, with Sue Spolin and Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the worst vacation ever. It started with overpriced dinners and ended in open-heart surgery. This miserable vacation is the subject of an essay in Jeffrey Wolfe's new collection of essays. Wolf is best known for his book, The Duke of Deception, his memoir about being the son of a con man. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.